Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke told a conference in Wyoming today that, yes, he's watching and stands ready to help. President Bush told mortgage holders that, yes, he's watching too and stands ready to help. Is anybody else watching and ready for this summer to be over? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Friday, the 31st and final day of August and the start of the Labor Day weekend. The Bush and Bernanke shows had Wall Street cupping its collective ear today. What's that you say, Mr. Fed Chairman? You stand ready to take additional actions as needed? Well, that's not exactly a promise to cut interest rates now, is it? And what's that you say, Mr. President? You've got a rescue plan for homeowners facing foreclosure? Okay. But your critics warn your remedies may be a tad too little too late. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on the debate in Washington over a taxpayer bailout of lenders and borrowers.
The White House will allow homeowners who've fallen behind on their payments to refinance their mortgages using the government's mortgage insurance agency, the Federal Housing Administration. That should help some delinquent borrowers avoid foreclosure. But only first-time homebuyers with good payment records up until a few months ago will be eligible. White House officials say that's about 240,000 families, a fraction of the more than 2 million mortgages that will adjust upwards over the next 2 years. At his Rose Garden announcement, Bush said the government shouldn't be rescuing speculators.
A federal bailout of lenders would only encourage a recurrence of the problem. It's not the government's job to bail out speculators or those who made the decision to buy a home they knew they could never afford.
Some in Congress, though, are in the mood to do a lot more. Democrats have proposed a $1 billion rescue fund for low-income borrowers. Another idea is to pay nonprofit organizations to advise delinquent homeowners on how to refinance with more favorable terms. Despite the White House's reluctance to bail out unscrupulous lenders, the Consumer Federation of America's Alan Fishbein says it's in the government's interest to help.
If we see a big run-up in foreclosures, it's going to affect the whole community. It's going to affect the next-door neighbors through depressed property values, and the need for generally higher levels of public service that come from concentrated foreclosures. So everybody's really in this one way or another.
President Bush is also asking Congress to allow the FHA to insure bigger loans and reduce down payment requirements. And he wants temporary tax relief for borrowers trying to renegotiate their mortgage debt. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So everyone from consumer advocates to members of Congress and now the president wants to extend a helping hand to homeowners on the verge of defaulting. But a new study from the Mortgage Bankers Association suggests some of those borrowers might not be so deserving of that help. It turns out house flippers and real estate speculators may be driving a huge share of the nation's mortgage woes. Marketplace's Sam Eaton has that story.
Investors who drove much of the double-digit gains in some of the nation's hottest real estate markets are now dragging those same markets down. The Mortgage Bankers Association reports that as many as a third of the defaulted loans in places like Nevada, Arizona, and Florida belong not to homeowners, but to speculators. Nicholas Retsinas directs the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies. He says it's a case where too many people bet on the market and lost.
They very commonly got adjustable rate mortgages because they only intended to hold the property for a little while. So as the market turned and turned so dramatically, it's not a surprise that investors are caught at the turn.
The Mortgage Bankers Association says many of those investors are simply walking away. Some put down as little as 2 to 3% on their properties. but the number of defaulting investors still pales against the ranks of homeowners in trouble. Retsina says more than 1 million people are on the verge of losing their homes, and he says that's who should be singled out for help. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
There's all kinds of blame to go around, and the ripple effects keep coming in this mortgage mess. And it's given us a good look at just how incestuous Wall Street can be. Early in the week, an analyst at investment bank Merrill Lynch downgraded his rating on competing bank Lehman Brothers. He cited Lehman's exposure to the recent credit turmoil. Then, a couple of days later, Lehman Brothers turned around and cut its earnings forecast for Merrill Lynch. Coincidence or something else? Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us questions like that come with the territory when banks cover banks.
Lehman Brothers' reassessment of Merrill Lynch yesterday may look like tit for tat, but Lehman didn't just pan Merrill Lynch. It lowered earnings estimates for Bear Stearns, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs. Analysts say all the big brokerage firms are pretty much in the same boat.
It isn't a boat right now. It's kind of a leaky sieve.
Analyst Richard Beauvais covers investment banks on behalf of investment bank Punk Siegel. He told his clients to sell stock in all five of the top brokerage firms back in July. Beauvais warned that the firm's exposure to risky debt could erode their profits. But he says it's typical for analysts to revise their ratings and estimates in the last week of the quarter. And what a quarter it's been.
It's only at the end of the quarter that they pull together some statistics from places like the New York Stock Exchange or the New York Federal Reserve, and then they come out with their estimates. So while it appears very clearly that these guys are trying to get each other, they're not really doing that.
Still, research analysts know the perils of covering the very industry that employs them. Brad Hintz follows banking stocks for Sanford Bernstein.
All of the companies that you cover treat you as if you're a KGB agent. Are you really an analyst, or are you really there to gain intelligence about the company?
If Lehman Brothers had wanted to avenge its downgrade by Merrill Lynch, it backfired. After Lehman's warning came out yesterday, stocks in all five of the top brokerage firms fell, including Lehman Brothers. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, the merry-go-round comes full circle. Details when we talk to our market watcher out in Washington. Rest is best. That's what most new mothers are told these days. Well, today's Washington Post updates a controversy that erupted a few years ago over a government ad campaign. The ads were pretty strong, implying kids would get sick if you didn't breastfeed. The Post reports this got the formula industry so worked up they hired lobbyists to go in and turn things around. And it worked. Ashley Milne-Tite reports on complaints that this incident is part of a bigger picture of political influence over public health.
Earlier this summer, former Surgeon General Richard Carmona testified before Congress. He said politically appointed government officials often stymied his efforts to promote public health because of outside considerations.
Anything that doesn't fit into the political appointee's ideological, theological, or political agenda is often ignored, marginalized, or simply buried.
Sidney Wolfe is with the Public Citizen Health Research Group in Washington. He says interference from the formula industry in the breastfeeding campaign should come as no surprise. He says business interests have long got in the way of good public health decisions.
If you're a company, you have, to be sure, a fiduciary responsibility to your stockholders to make as much money as possible. But when the process of doing that starts having adverse consequences on public health, then someone needs to step in.
But Christina Pearson of the Department of Health and Human Services says industry lobbyists were not the only group that precipitated a rethink of the pro-breastfeeding ad campaign. She says early drafts of the ads caused consternation among scientists.
The changes that were made to the campaign were based on the advice of the top science and public health officials in this nation. They told us what the science would support.
And she says it wouldn't support the original ad's implication that certain illnesses, like diabetes, could be directly linked to lack of breastfeeding. The campaign that went ahead still featured ads with a heavily pregnant woman riding a bucking bronco. They implied that not breastfeeding was just as risky for the baby. Pearson says those ads still managed to offend plenty of people. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Monday has been set aside by the federal government to celebrate the labor movement and the achievements of American workers. It's not always easy to be an American worker these days, thanks to offshoring and the rising tide of imported goods. So when Congress gets back after the holiday, it's reviewing the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. It was designed to help U.S. workers who lose their jobs because of these outside influences. But commentator Beth Shulman says one new proposal for the program could damage the middle class.
This year, some lawmakers have come up with a new idea. Pay something called wage insurance to people who lose their jobs and have to take lower paid ones. They want to pay thousands of laid off workers the difference between what they used to earn and what they earn in that new, lower paid job for up to 2 years at a cap of $10,000. Sounds good, but it's only for those who take jobs for far less pay and give up the right to federal training funds. What a raw deal. All wage insurance does is fuel downward mobility by pushing workers out of the middle class. When Uncle Sam cuts the subsidy after year two, then what? Then, once middle-class workers will end up stuck in low-wage jobs. We've got to do better than a scheme to rob low-wage Peter to pay unemployed higher-skilled Paul. Why not instead give newly unemployed workers health insurance? Add some funds for real retraining to help them find well-paying jobs at the same time as they get transitional support. And why not extend the program to service workers, like those in call centers who suffered the same fate as factory workers, but who get no help now? Let's shore up the middle class instead. The richest country in the world should be able to provide workers hit by layoffs with the skills they need to move into the new well-paid jobs. Let's not punish them and their families further. That's the least we can do for the hardworking men and women who lose their jobs through no fault of their own.
Beth Shulman is the author of The Betrayal of Work. What is being middle class anyway? Tell us what you think at marketplace.org. Just click on contact. Time to check the week on Wall Street, and our Dallas stockbroker has somehow disappeared on this Labor Day weekend, and so with us is Kim Clark. She's a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, and a lot of the smart people on Wall Street took the week off, so this was that's you and me, I guess, are the exceptions, right?
Yes, so I guess we are not the smart ones, but I have to say, looking at this week, it seems to be a bit of a microcosm for the summer. We started out, we had, you know, a 280-point drop in the Dow one day, then it went up by 250 points the next, and it went down by 50 and up by 160. And essentially, we're back where we started, aren't we?
Just about. There's an old saying on Wall Street, sell in May and go away, buy again on Labor Day. And really, a lot of people would have been smart to do that because we would have avoided a lot of stomach churning over the last 3 months. If you look at the like the Wilshire 5000 index, which is the broadest index of the stock market, mm-hmm. If you had bought in January and sold at the end of May, you would have done very well. You would have had a nice 10-12% return. And now, of course, it's down a little bit. So if you came back and bought on Monday, you know, you'd start at a lower base. You'd be doing pretty well.
So what's with all the hand-wringing over this roller coaster and all the waiting with bated breath to see what the Fed is going to do about interest rates?
Okay, well, the subprime problem keeps on. It's not like there's one big shoe. There's a lot of little pieces of shoes that keep on dropping.
A lot of
dropping.
Little baby shoes all over the place.
A lot of little baby shoes. A lot of octopus shoes.
Yeah.
So the problems keep on popping up in new places, and it's making people very uncertain. There's a phrase on Wall Street, a word on Wall Street that people use. It's transparency. They don't have any transparency. They can't see how far the problem is, how deep the problem is. And so the uncertainty is what Wall Street hates. And that's why this summer what you've had is a flight to quality. And that's why you've seen the tremendous changes in the prices of treasuries. Short-term treasuries have boomed.
Mm-hmm.
They went down a little bit today as a result of the Bush and Bernanke speeches. But, you know, if you were in bonds, you've done treasury bonds, rather, you've done very well.
So these days where we're seeing upward movements in the market, is that really just bargain hunting out there?
I have spoken to some traders, and I was talking to a guy at T. Rowe Price earlier today who said they're definitely seeing some bottom fishing. And
yeah.
No wonder. You look at a company like Citibank, huge bank. I mean, the question is how big is their subprime problem? But if it's all out there now, their dividend yield is terrific.
So can you look into your crystal ball and tell me when this all will settle down?
No, I don't think anybody knows I don't think anybody knows how many more shoes are going to drop.
Yeah.
And the question is, you look at, for example, the home builders. Again, if you were looking for a bargain, gosh, the home builders are awfully cheap right now. But how low is this stock? How low is this housing market going to go? Everybody's so uncertain. People on Wall Street just don't know how to feel for the bottom yet.
Kim Clark is a senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. You got a long weekend ahead of you?
Very long.
Enjoy it. Coming up, Vietnam's visa program gets a facelift.
I can foresee visions of booming business between the Vietnamese American in Vietnam and vice versa.
But first, let's do the numbers. High hopes for a Federal Reserve interest rate cut, or maybe just wishful thinking, boosted the markets today. The Dow plumped up 119 points, 0.9% to finish at 13,357. The Nasdaq shined up 31 points, 1.2% to end at 2596. The S&P added 16 points, 1.1% to close at 1473. For the week, the Dow dropped 0.2%. The Nasdaq gained 0.8%. The S&P lost 0.4%. But, and here's what Kim was pointing out about context, all three indexes enjoyed their first monthly gains since May. Bonds were mixed, and the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.53%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Marketplace's podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday, Labor Day. Relax and barbecue. The markets are closed for the holiday. President Bush leaves for Australia, where he'll attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. And punk rocker Steve Jones has a birthday. Sex Pistols guitarist turns 52. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Have a great weekend.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl. We talk a lot on this program about the Chinese market, how enticing it is to multinational companies, low-cost labor to make products, a billion customers to buy them, what's not to like. Well, the foreign investment climate may get a little tougher with today's passage of a new anti-monopoly law. Our China Bureau Chief Scott Tong joins us from Shanghai. And Scott, ni hao.
Hi, Tess. Very nice. Ni hao.
Did I get that right?
You did.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this antitrust law. And why would this hurt foreign companies?
Well, tucked into this antitrust law, which actually looks very nice, is a small clause that says foreign companies that want to buy Chinese companies, they have to go through this national economic security check before any acquisition can be approved. Now, it might sound good, it might sound like the right thing to do, but it's worded very vaguely. And so a lot of multinational companies and the people who represent them look at it and say, uh-oh, you know, this could get political in a hurry. And it's part of what some consider this larger foreign investment climate that's getting a little chillier in China.
Does this really mean that their protectionism wall is being erected?
There are a couple cases going on that people talk about. One of them is Carlyle, the big buyout company, has been trying for a long time to buy a stake in a Chinese construction company, and it's still not approved. Goldman Sachs had a proposed acquisition of a share of an appliance maker rejected recently in China. And if you put it all together, one analyst, one investment person in China said, the bureaucrats take a look at a case. It never really comes back and they say no. He says, it's kind of like my wife. She doesn't like an idea that I have. She never really rejects it. I just never get an answer. And so the bureaucracy here just never gives these foreign companies an answer.
Well, so obviously U.S. companies having a tough time with this, but what's the Chinese perspective?
Well, China, as you know, is a big place, and it of course, depends who you talk to. On the one hand, there is a sense on the street that they've opened their arms here in China to foreign companies, and it's all good. There's a lot of foreign brands here. There's a Bentley dealership down the street from our office. There's McDonald's, and I'm a big fan of Dove chocolate. There's a whole lot of that here. And on the other hand, there's a growing sense among some government officials, or from what they say, that there's this economic nationalism going on. And they don't need these companies the way they needed to before. It's time for China to grow its own companies. It's time to improve the Made in China label. So they want to grow Chinese label chip makers and auto parts companies to move up the value chain the way Japan did, the way Taiwan did, the way Korea did.
Well, the Made in China label has certainly been taking a beating over the last several months with you know, the pet food and the toothpaste and the toys. So how does this national security stuff fit into that current debate?
Well, the fear from some in the business community here in China is that this is another legal tool that could be used, in this case from China, kind of to raise a reason for a business deal not to go through. And in other words, a kind of protectionism that we may be seeing more around the world. We've read about similar worries in Europe about certain companies buying energy companies over there. And so the sense among some is we may be seeing a little more protectionism, a little more raising the national security flag.
And Beijing is not going to want to look like a hypocrite here. I mean, a lot of their growth has been dependent on all this foreign investment, and to turn around then and erect these trade barriers.
Well, that's right. And no one is saying that China is shutting its doors kind of all the way. There are still a lot of factories obviously going up in China. It's just, is the environment changing? And Beijing also wants to go out and spend China's money overseas, kind of the other way around. And Chinese firms are going out to Africa and Southeast Asia and purchasing stakes in oil and energy companies. And they don't want to look like they're trying to have it both ways, that China is trying to do some acquisitions overseas, but they want to stop them all at home. So it's going to be a tricky balance here.
All right. Marketplace's Scott Tong joining us from Shanghai. Thanks so much, Scott.
Okay, Tess. Thanks.
Vietnam is rolling out the welcome mat to expats. It's offering five-year visas to Vietnamese who live abroad, many of whom fled the country after the Vietnam War. Business leaders say it could open the door to more trade. But some Vietnamese here in the U.S. are turning up their noses at Hanoi's offer. Jordan Davis has more from Little Saigon in Orange County, California.
Nha Phi fled Vietnam on a rickety boat in 1979. He was persecuted for supporting the South Vietnamese regime during the war, but decades later, he returned.
I met all my friends during the high school. We are the same class, and now they are very successful in Vietnam, and they have the factory, very big one.
The visit changed everything for Phi. He quit his construction job and started U.S. Hi-Fi, a company that, in spite of its name, doesn't sell stereo systems. It imports building materials made in the factories Phi visited in Vietnam. The U.S. Hi-Fi warehouse is stacked with tile, parquet, and bathroom fixtures.
These cabinets right here are from Vietnam.
Nha Phi's son Vin shows off a new design.
See how it just closes automatically. This is a big selling point. So, you know, a lot of people who go to the bathroom at night, you know, and they don't want to wake up their spouses and whatnot.
Spouse-friendly bathroom cabinets account for some of the $8.5 billion of Vietnamese exports that came to the U.S. last year. Growing numbers of Vietnamese emigres are now doing business with the country they once fled. And business could get a boost this weekend when the government in Hanoi begins offering five-year visas to overseas Vietnamese.
I can foresee visions of booming business between the Vietnamese American in Vietnam and vice versa.
Co Pham is president of the Vietnamese American Chamber of Commerce. He says the new visa program will help people avoid bureaucratic unpleasantries.
Before, each time you go to Vietnam, you have to go to visa. The visa made people in K may give you a hard time, harassing you, ask you 1,000 questions why you want to go.
David Danis is an economist with Tufts University. He says Vietnam isn't really introducing these visas for business reasons. He says the economy there is doing fine. It grew at a rate of 9% last year. Danis says by rolling out this visa program, Vietnam's leaders are hoping to improve their image in the U.S.
I think they're very interested in defusing opposition. And of course, the more that the Vietnamese community feels they're welcome, the more likely that they will not be hostile to the government.
The Vietnamese government may find itself fighting an uphill battle. Many Vietnamese Americans still pledge their loyalty to the old South Vietnamese regime and even fly its distinctive yellow flag over their homes and businesses. They're suspicious of Hanoi. Hoa Pham is a travel agent in Little Saigon. She arranges trips to Vietnam for emigres, but says none of her clients are interested in the five-year visa. Mostly, she says, because they don't want to give their personal information to Vietnamese officials.
They rather pay the regular visa right now, and that's it. They don't want the government in Vietnam to know anything about themselves.
So a lot of people here still don't trust the Vietnamese government?
No, they don't.
The Phi family at U.S. Hi-Fi isn't sure if they'll take up Hanoi's offer of long-term visas. Vin Phi says the program won't make any difference to his plans to keep doing business in Vietnam.
If we import stuff from Vietnam to here, that means, you know, there's work in Vietnam. So I think economically, it makes sense.
The Vietnamese government expects a flood of applicants for the visas, but there doesn't seem to be much interest in communities like Little Saigon. After all, people like Vin Phi say they've been finding ways to do business with Vietnam for years, regardless of their visas. In Little Saigon, California, I'm Jordan Davis for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, 22 million to one odds are not good. So if you won the lottery once, would you keep playing? Well, Eugene Angelo did, and 11 years after his first big win, the 81-year-old just hit the jackpot again. In 1996, the New York resident won $2.5 million. This year, he won double that. It's the third time in history that someone has hit the New York State Lotto twice, but bear this in mind, the odds are exactly the same each time you play. Statistically, you could hit a jackpot every single time. Of course, you shouldn't be gambling in the first place. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 119 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq gained 31 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 rose 16 points, 1.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Next time, taking a page from Shakespeare's corporate playbook.
So, Claudius as a crisis leader, yes or no? We say thumbs down.
Oh, I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a terrific holiday weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.